Official, it's Danielle Fischel,
Ryder Strong,
and Will Friedle from Pod Meets World.
Does friendly have a taste? If it does, it's probably like Hello's peppermint-flavored anti-plaque and whitening toothpaste.
Brush away plaque, show tartar who's boss, and remove surface stains to naturally whiten.
Hello's thoughtful and flavor-forward products make brushing your teeth feel like a confetti-filled bathroom dance party.
So say hello to Hello with the always cruelty-free, never tested on animals toothpaste that's made to spread smiles.
Visit HelloProducts.com and let Hello add some everyday yay into your life.
Legends, the greatest social casino experience has arrived at Legends.com. With thousands of the best free-to-play casino-style games, chances to earn millions of bonus coins and win real money. Legends is revolutionizing the Vegas experience wherever you are. If you love winning, then you'll love playing at Legends.com. Legends is a free-to-play social casino. Void where prohibited. Play responsibly. Visit Legends.com for more information. Legends with a Z.com is legendary fun.
Hi, everyone. I'm Ashley Banfield, and this is Drop Dead Serious. And today I'm talking about a case that has really captivated the nation. I don't think that's hyperbole. If you have been following, and I think you have, Karen Reed and everything she's been going through for the last few years, your head is probably spinning with the last few developments and the upcoming big development. If you're just coming into the case, let me just give you a recap with a timeline. Sometimes it really helps put everything in perspective. Let me start with January 29th of 2022. In a nutshell, Karen Reed had this boyfriend, John O'Keefe. He's a police officer in Massachusetts. They are out drinking with another female friend at one point in the evening, and Karen drops John O'Keefe off at a party of other cops, a house party. She's hammered. He's hammered. She's fighting with him and doesn't want to go into the party. He gets out of the car. Her story is she then drives away. And unfortunately, the story from police officers and the state of Massachusetts is that you did not drive away. You put it in reverse and you drove over him and killed him. Because John O'Keefe's battered body was found dead in a snowbank outside the house party. February 1st, 2022, Karen Reed, again, John O'Keefe's girlfriend, is arrested and she is charged with second degree murder. But she's also charged with manslaughter, motor vehicle homicide, and leaving the scene of a deadly crash. On April 29th, in 2024, trial begins, opening statements are delivered. July 1st, 2024, after about 25 hours of deliberation, the jury reports they're stuck. It's an impasse, and that leads the judge in the case, Judge Beverly Canone, to declare a mistrial in Karen Reed's case. After the trial, though, and this is where it gets weird, reports from jurors suggest that they were actually leaning towards an acquittal on two of the most serious charges against Karen Reed. And you know what's most important about that? They apparently, through investigation, were absolutely together on the fact that she wasn't guilty of second-degree murder, but that they were trying to noodle themselves through the manslaughter. Okay, that's important. A new trial was set for Karen Reed because the prosecutor said, well, we're not going to leave it at a mistrial. We're going to try her again. And they decided to do that. They have a new special prosecutor whose name is Hank Brennan, who's on the case. February 18th of this year, 2025, Judge Canone suspends a hearing and says she's got, quote, grave concern, end quote, over new information regarding the defense's handling of expert witnesses. More specifically, did those witnesses get paid by the defense attorney for Karen Reed without that defense attorney disclosing the payment to the court? It's a big issue. You're going to hear about that in a second. February 25th, 2025. The hearing resumes to address these concerns, focusing on potential misconduct by the defense team, specifically David Yannetti and Alan Jackson, the two defense attorneys. Feb 27, 2 days later, 2025. Defense files a motion themselves, and they want to dismiss this case. They want to dismiss all charges, citing, quote, extraordinary governmental misconduct. But there's so much more, like so much more. Karen Reed has come up with some pretty fascinating stuff that may be pointing to a big cover-up by all those cops who were inside the house party, that it might have been a different story, that John O'Keefe might have actually gone into that house and gotten into a big fight and been killed by the guys in the house and their German Shepherd, who she says left all the injuries on his arm, and that they staged this to make it look like Karen Reed did it, including bashing in her taillight while the car was impounded and sprinkling the taillight all throughout the area where John O'Keefe was found in the snowbank. This is her story. So two very divergent stories. And in the middle of all that, a lot of weird stuff going on with prosecutors, allegations against the defense, doing stuff they shouldn't have, a mistrial because the jury actually decided that she was not guilty of the murder charge, but they couldn't figure out whether she was guilty of the manslaughter and other stuff. And the failure of the court in Massachusetts to even ask the jury when they said we're deadlocked, well, have you come to an agreement on any of the charges? That's how easy this could have been dispensed with. If the court itself, if the defense or the prosecutors themselves had said, okay, you're having trouble, we get it, it happens, but you've got multiple charges in front of you, did you decide on any of them? Then Karen Reed would have been cleared of murder. As it happens, she's going to be retried April 1st. That's the plan. And murder is on the table, despite her defense attorney valiantly trying to fight that through an appeal and continuing to fight through an appeal. Plan is to retry her. Is it double jeopardy? Is it fair? Should it have happened? How about all that other stuff? Trooper Michael Proctor, the lead investigator, has now been fired by the Massachusetts State Police. Not suspended, not reassigned. He's been fired. An internal investigation confirmed what the defense has been alleging for months, and that is that Proctor sent crude and misogynistic text messages about Karen Reed during his investigation of Karen Reed, that he shared confidential information with the unauthorized group of people, and that he even drank alcohol while on duty and while driving his cruiser. So how does the prosecution get around this in the second trial? That alone would be a bombshell, but there is more. Victoria George, she was picked as an alternate juror during Reed's first murder trial, and she has now officially joined the defense team. And get this, even though Victoria George was a juror, turns out Victoria George is also a lawyer. Let that sink in for a second. A juror in Karen Reed's first murder trial, who is also a lawyer, is now working for Karen Reed in her second murder trial. Should be noted that Ms. George did not sit in on deliberations because she was an alternate, but she does say that what she saw in the courtroom shook her faith in the system. And now she says she wants to help fight what she calls a miscarriage of justice. All of this comes as the judge denied the defense's motion to dismiss this case outright. They argued that the misconduct by law enforcement was so egregious that the case should be thrown out. But the judge disagreed with the defense, saying, sorry, trial must go forward. And finally, prosecution tried to get access to text messages between Karen Reed and her attorney. I know, right? You normally can't do that. But prosecution says that defense waived attorney-client privilege when they went ahead and spoke publicly. The judge shut that down, saying, nope, privilege still stands. So where are we? Jury selection is about to begin April 1st, 2025. And if this is just the prelude, imagine what the trial is going to be. Well, thank God I've got one of the best in the business to help me navigate through this sort of crazy swamp of nuttiness. And it's Bob Mata, the host of Defense Diaries. He's a defense attorney. He's really, really clever when it comes to this stuff. And he knows the law a lot better than I do. So without further ado, here we go. Bob Mata, you're such a smart legal mind, like a go-to. You're the perfect person to ask, why is the Karen Reed case so endearing to so many people? So why do so many people want to know every second what's happening in the Karen Reed case?
I think that there were two cases that really kind of like struck the public conscience, and it was Karen Reed and the Richard Allen case. And the thing that was significant in both of those cases is that an unusual thing happened, and that was that the defense in both of those cases kind of put out their theory of defense long before the general public ever hears it in most cases. So in Karen Reed, you had them filing the motion to dismiss, where you get this whole cop conspiracy, House Long to Die, and they like this massive conspiracy. So when that came out, people started to read it. It became kind of more public knowledge. And when you have that situation, because we are very accustomed in this country particularly to only hearing the state's theory of the case, you very rarely hear the defense say, all right, well, that's what they're saying happened. Well, this is what we're saying happened. And having it out there for public consumption leading up to a trial for a year plus.
One of the things that I am like fixated on, it's a small thing in this trial, but I feel like it's super important for everyone. And that is that Karen Reed said something like an utterance that the police have been using against her and the prosecutors have been using against her, and is, I hit him. But I always feel like, was that with a question mark at the end or an exclamation point at the end? Because you could say it as, I hit him, or I hit him. And I always think about my cousin Vinny, and I shot the clerk, you know,
right.
Which if you take the intonation and the lilt out of the end of your voice, it's I shot the clerk. And I say that's important for people because it's the reason your lawyer tells you, do not talk till right. I'm there. Because these things that you have no intention of doing or saying can be used against you. And that's a perfect example.
And they will. I mean, that's part of the Miranda for a reason, that they can and will use everything that you say against you in a court of law. And that always bears itself out. You gave a much cleaner version of what I usually tell my clients, which is, you know, shut the F up. So
STFU is usually
right,
what
exactly,
we write. Yeah.
Exactly. You know, but the concept is you just don't talk, especially in a situation where you're innocent. Because if they've invited you to their house, meaning they've invited you to the police station because they need to talk to you, you know that they're looking at you for something. Like if you're a lay witness or just somebody that they want to talk to, or they're going to go canvassing, they'll knock on your door. It'll be way more low key than that. If they're inviting you in and you haven't done it, but in all situations, you should never talk to law enforcement, which sounds terrible to say, but it's true.
It doesn't feel right, because if you are innocent, you want to profess your innocence right away, and you feel, right. I have nothing to hide. I have nothing to hide.
Right.
Too bad. You have nothing to hide, but the things you say can be twisted. Right. There's another, like a total aside here, not a Karen Reed issue here, but when you're stopped at a traffic stop and the officer says, do you know why I pulled you over? If you say, was I speeding? You're acknowledging that you don't know if you were speeding.
Right.
So, you know, you shouldn't say that, even though you are trying to be honest and, you know, and have a good narrative and conversation with the officer. If you say, was it speeding?
Right.
You know, it's on body cam.
Right. Yeah. And you've basically acknowledged the fact that, like, maybe you were breaking the law. So, yeah, the best thing is
you can't say later, I wasn't speeding, because you already asked if you were. Yeah.
Right. Yeah. And it's that. In that situation, you basically just say, hello,
no,
officer.
Sir. yeah. And no, anger. Sir.
Yeah, exactly.
Do you know why you were pulled over? No, sir.
No.
And be very polite.
That's right.
Yeah. I always say, like, I remember, like, from a very early age, well, look, we're older, right? So we right. were terrified of police and we behaved ourselves. And when you watch Live PD / OP Live, you see how disrespectful and horrifying people are to police, who usually start the conversation in a respectful way. I always say, put your interior light on immediately. Put your hands, put all four windows down. All four. Don't just put yours down. Put every window down so that as they approach, they can see that you've done something to allow them to see in, and put your hands up on the wheel up high.
Right, 100%.
So they can see your hands without gloves on them, without anything, and just be so polite, because that woman or man who's walking up to your car is in a position where this could be the last thing they ever see in their life before the gun goes off, you know, and you're racing off because you're a felon who's about to be caught and thrown back in jail. So it's very, very scary for that officer. And yeah. Maybe that anxiety is what comes out when they seem edgy.
100%. And beyond that, I mean, take the person out of the uniform and just think about your daily interactions with people. I mean, I think that old axiom that you get more bees with honey than you do with vinegar is very true. So if you come at them hard, I mean, like if you were in a grocery store and you start yelling at the person who's checking you out, you're going to get a pretty combative thing. Now, obviously, the end game is not nearly as significant as if you're dealing with the police officer.
Yeah.
But the concept is the same. You know, it's just treat others as you want to be treated. And frankly, if you're acting completely defensive, that puts them on high alert immediately. So
and things will take longer and go worse. Yeah, you're right.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
So what a diversion from Karen Reed. But let's talk dog bite theory, because I also find this one fascinating that, you know, dog bite science is not something we have often seen in a courtroom. I've heard the smell science in Casey Anthony's case. You know, some people call it voodoo science and whatever else. But the dog bite science in this case is important. You want to take it from there and give me your perspectives on why dog bites in this case matter?
Well, I mean, they matter going back to our little conversation about, you know, that initial motion dismiss where they kind of laid out the entire theory, which was the defense theory is that John O'Keefe went into that house, something went down, and that Chloe, the German Shepherd, had something to do with it, which in their theory, Chloe or another dog caused the injuries on John O'Keefe's arm. So,
as opposed to Karen Reed's SUV.
SUV, exactly. Yeah. So, you know, it's again, we've got two absolutely competing theories that are one has nothing to do with the other. The other one is kind of a difficult sell when you're trying to convince 12 people in a box that, you know, all these cops were conspiring to do this. And, you know, it's a difficult sell. So the concept of trying to figure out what happened to his arm then became a very important part to the defense. And, you know, I've seen the pictures of the arm. You've seen the pictures of the arm. I'm no dog bite expert. Do they look like they could be dog bites or scratches? They do to me, you know? So, and I think that from the perspective of a normal person, when you're looking at it, when there is no real reasonable explanation that's been proffered by the Commonwealth as to how those particular injuries were caused, you want to try to hammer it home by putting on an expert who's going to say, yes, you know, I'm very learned in the ways of dog bite injuries. And in my opinion, what I'm looking at, these wounds were caused by a canine. So, I mean, and you want to do that to hammer it home, because in court, lawyers' words mean little to nothing. It's all about what's brought in evidence. So, you know, you have to have an expert like Dr. Russell come in and testify. They'll give you, you know, her CV. They'll put it all out there. This is her experience. This is what makes her an expert in the field. And then they'll go through the process of her identifying why she believes and her methodology as to why she believes that a canine caused those injuries. And then it's up to the Commonwealth, in this case, to rebut that, either with their own expert or on cross-examination.
And that's when I love the word reasonable, because it's the number one question that so many jurors come back with as they've been dismissed to deliberate in a case. They send the question back to the judge. What does reasonable mean in reasonable doubt? Can you define reasonable? And the judges usually put out the same response, which is, what's reasonable to you? That's your inner fabric. I can't tell you what's reasonable to you, because what's reasonable to one person is that no one should drink before the age of 21. And what's reasonable to another person is, for God's sake, I can give my 18-year-old boy a beer. And so everybody's a little different there. And all you need is one of those jurors to say it is reasonable to think maybe the dog bites, maybe those were dog bites. And that expert sounded reasonable. And I'm kind of there with the, I'm not sure.
Right.
It's not definitive, but it's reasonable doubt. It's not definitive proof,
right.
You know?
Exactly. And it's, as an attorney, the concept of reasonable doubt has always been one of my biggest hangups, because if you look from state to state and you go through their jury instructions where they try to define what reasonable doubt is, inevitably they're always different. There is no standard explanation of what it is, and it comes back to haunt defense attorneys so often because there is no way to really explain it in a way that is just concise and clear, you know? So it always leaves kind of this buffer zone of doubt in terms of the jurors' minds. Are they applying it correctly?
L-E-T-E-N-P-C. Your night in just got legendary. Get ready to chase the rush, spin, win, and redeem instantly straight to your bank account at legendswithaz.com. With free-to-play slots, blackjack, keno, roulette, and more, experience all the thrills of Vegas without leaving your couch. Legends has it all.
Legends is a free-to-play social casino. Void where prohibited. Must be 18 plus. Play responsibly. Visit legends.com for full details.
Get in the game now and score a 50% bonus on your first purchase only at legendswithaz.com.
You won't see the engineer that slams the Nissan Rogue's door 13,920 times, or the corrosive chamber that simulates 15 years of life in 5 months, or the Rogue heat-baked for over 300 combined hours. What you will see is a vehicle that can take punch after punch and keep rolling. Nissan, number one in new vehicle quality among mainstream brands by J.D. Power. We put it through the worst so you get its best. For J.D. Power 2025 U.S. Initial Quality Study Award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Awards based on 2025 model year. Newer models may be shown.
Are you allowed in summation to say to jurors, let me talk about reasonable doubt for a hot minute. Reasonable is what seems fair to you, not to your neighbor, not to the other juror. There's no definition of what is reasonable to you. But we all know what reasonable means. It's not loony, and it's not beyond shadow of a doubt. It's reasonable. It's a little less than that. Are you allowed to use those kinds of words to describe it and define it to them in summation?
Absolutely. And, you know, I think that that was one of the problems with the defense in Karen Reed's first trial is they did not focus on that aspect in closing enough in terms of hammering home what reasonable doubt means and the concept that the defense has no burden, even though they're putting forth this conspiracy defense. They had no obligation, even though it seemed like it was a burden shift, because Yannetti, the first words that came out of his mouth during his opening is Karen Reed was framed, you know? So like when they did that, even though there is no actual burden shifting that takes place in the minds of jurors, there is.
Yes. Oh, yes. Prove it. They want to say, prove it. If you didn't do it, prove it. Exactly. That's the first thing that goes through their minds. Even if they're not saying those words, that's their feeling. I'm in a courtroom. You look guilty over there at defense table, so prove you aren't. And you're right. But I do think there is a burden unspoken of defense attorneys to reach into the gut of a juror and through their work say, is it reasonable that this might not be true?
Right.
Is it just reasonable to think it might not be true? And make it simple. Like OJ's case was the masterclass in how to F up simplicity and a reasonable person's gut. I would have put on such a short case there and say, what's reasonable to you?
Right.
Is it reasonable that there's some mass conspiracy between 100 different outlets at the LAPD and the prosecutor's office to think they all mass conspired within 10 minutes in an evening, you know, like, and then you've got me. But if you clutter everything, and sometimes I think that lawyers and prosecutors and defense attorneys, they get wound up in their own business and they forget that that's a hairdresser.
Right.
That's a manicurist. That's a car mechanic over there. And that's an accountant. And they don't understand your terms.
100%.
They don't understand why you're going there with this. Well, like, what's going on here? Just tell me the story. I think they forget to tell a story, you know?
And
the biggest part of that story is what you just said. Let me tell you a little bit about what's reasonable doubt and what should be reasonable to you.
It's huge because that concept, when they go back there and if they don't understand what it means, you hammer home 2 points if you're on the defense side of it. You're hammering home the point that we had to prove nothing to you. Now, that being said, the reality is I've never walked into a courtroom on
and
a
said
trial.
That.
Not thinking
a
that
shady
I can
AF.
Right. No, I always think that I have to prove that my client's innocent if I have the ability to do it, because like in some cases, as a defense attorney, you'll have a defense. Either it's an affirmative defense or you have your own theory of what happened. And sometimes you don't. And that's where you're leaning into a reasonable doubt. You're hoping that the jury will find that there's reasonable doubt there. And you have to do that sometimes by just picking apart the state's evidence and saying, well, that evidence is weak. And, you know, so in terms of the prosecution, it's a different thing. And I saw, I can't remember which trial it was. You know, I think it was Zachary Hughes. And I actually liked what the state had done in terms of, from their perspective, trying to get across to the jury what it meant from the state's perspective. And she had just taken a large pad of paper and she put in kind of like, it looked like an old hangman game, you know, when you play with your kids, where you put the dashes for the letters. And she put in like C blank blank M M O N and then sense spelled out. And she's like, all right, so beyond a reasonable doubt is a lot like the Wheel of Fortune. So she's like, I'm going to hold this up to you. Now you can look at it and you know exactly what that is. There's no question in your mind that you know that that spells out common sense, even though there's two
missing pieces.
There. Right. So like, and I thought that that was a really, really effective way for the state to be able to say, okay, that is what beyond a reasonable doubt is. As far as the defense goes.
Wait. Would you be allowed to, could you see a judge saying that's not appropriate? Can you do that in summation to show how simple this is?
That's what she did. Like that,
and you can do that anywhere, any jurisdiction. But can a judge ever shut you down and say you can't do that?
I mean, if you're giving an improper, instruction to the jury, yeah.
Like you're bringing in an artifact. You're bringing in an exhibit and showing them something that hasn't been introduced in trial. And I always wonder, is that one of those gray areas where you could be shut down, where the layperson doesn't know why you're being shut down, but legally, according to jurisprudence, you can't do that.
Typically, no, because remember, like, and the judge always admonishes the jury, and there's typically an instruction in the jury instructions that says, look, whatever the lawyers are saying is not evidence. And closing arguments are exactly that. It's argument. That's all it is. So they can give whatever weight they deem that they should give it in terms of what that lawyer is arguing, as long as they understand that that's not evidence in the case. All it is argument from the lawyer that their story is the right story. So like, but from the defense attorney side of it, it's harder to come up with like a really good analogy that works, that makes it clear, other than, you know, you'll typically hear, if in your mind you're thinking, well, that probably happened, that's reasonable doubt. Or maybe that happened, that's reasonable doubt. If you're there, if you're thinking that there's another plausible explanation as to what may have happened, that's reasonable doubt. So it's like you really have to kind of flesh out those things. And you're absolutely allowed to bring that up to a jury trying to explain what the concept is, because that is the burden, you know? So like you're always going to be able to try to clarify it to the jury in terms of that very, very difficult job that they have, which is to go back and, you know, judge another person, where the end result they ultimately know in a criminal case is most likely to be the loss of liberty and freedom.
And some jurors are unreasonable. I mean, the reality is the motorist ahead of you, that if you get into a fender bender who brings out a baseball bat, is an unreasonable person. And that could be a juror at some point.
100%.
You have to you got to get all these personalities together. Some are very unreasonable. Some are morons, didn't pay attention. And some are really, really invested and very reasonable. And somehow that has to come together with all 12, you know, with the same, you know, decision. Unless
we
get that
have. We could do a podcast episode for 5 hours talking about the importance of picking a jury and how hard it is, because it's exactly what you said. You're getting people from all walks of life. You're getting very little information. It's not like, what was the movie, the Grisham novel, where they were getting these like massive dossiers. It was about Runaway Jury.
Yeah, it was just insane.
Like they were getting these huge dossiers about who these jurors were, and they're on huge computers typing, you know, pulling up all that. That's not how it is. Like in Illinois, for instance, where we practice, we get the morning of trial, we get sheets that basically is bio, and they'll have some questions that they asked. And that's all we get. Now, in cases that are bigger, where you're really worried about the publicity
being an issue. Their social
media. Yeah. Like the first thing I'm doing when I'm sitting in the courtroom is I'm digging in. So if Allison, my partner and my wife, is sitting next to me and she's going to be doing the first panel of voir dire, I'm going through their socials to try to get a sense of who they are. like a lot of times people's politics matter. Like, do you want a conservative jury? Do you want a liberal juror? You know, like, so you're trying to pick apart all the different things that you can get and call out of that information on socials.
If you're defending a police officer and their, you know, their bio picture is the American flag in gray and blue, that's your juror.
That's your guy,
you know,
or gal. Yeah, 100%. Yeah. So, but it's so hard to know what they're thinking or what they're going to think. And they, like, judges will limit you a lot more during that voir dire, during the questioning of the jurors on the front end, than they will in argument towards the end, because they want to try to limit it. And we're always wanting to try to dig deep because we're trying to get a sense of who that person is.
Alan Jackson should be really good at this. And I'll tell you a little anecdote. I don't know if many people know about this. Alan Jackson was the prosecutor in California for Phil Spector's case, for his trial number one that was hung. And one of the jurors in Phil Spector's case was a Dateline producer.
Wow.
And I kept thinking, how did that happen? That's impossible, because a Dateline producer will be on that story after, because they've got the inside information. 100%. And that story is a heck of a lot more sellable if he's guilty. And so that was number one that drove me crazy. And the other issue is, one of them in the hung jury, which was trial number one, was an engineer. And I remember learning this from my Court TV colleagues back in the day. You never want an engineer on a case, because engineers must connect every dot. There can't be a stressor point anywhere in a bridge. Everything must be connected. And thus, if you have chasms in a case, which we always do, they will not be able to see through it. And they will say it's reasonable doubt because you didn't connect this to that. And that's, guess who hung that jury?
Spector.
It was the engineer. So Alan Jackson was there for that. And I feel like now he's on the other side. He's defending Karen Reed. He should be extraordinarily astute. And he's a very smart guy, by the way. I know him well. He's very, very smart. And very good at his job. He should be very good at that.
I don't know if he's Robert Alessi smart, though.
Go on.
Yeah, he's a brilliant guy. But no, yeah, Alan's an unbelievable attorney. And, you know, I mean, he's kind of going through it right now.
And he's been through it. He's been through when the jury sinks you. When that one juror sinks you. So he'd be so mindful about jury selection.
I know. And it's just so hard to do, though. Like, so probably my worst mistake ever in a trial is, I was trying a case. And it was just a DUI, but my client wanted to bring it to trial. I'm like, okay. So we brought it to trial, and I was employing kind of a rather peculiar defense. It was the defense of necessity, meaning that there was a reason. There was a necessity for him to be driving. It was related to something that was going on domestically at his house. Legally, it was an interesting, it was a very novel defense. So I'm like,
very
going
novel.
Into it, I'm like, all right, I was telling Allison, there was a former prosecutor from that county who was no longer a prosecutor, but a prosecutor who I knew that was in the jury veneer. And I was, Allison like came in, she wasn't trying the case with me. And I'm like, I'm thinking about taking this prosecutor only because of this novel defense. I'm worried that it might go over just an average lay person's head and they won't get it. So I'm hoping
he'll explain it.
She hears it. Right. She was a she.
She'll explain it. She'll explain it in the jury room.
So, I mean, talk about never putting a prosecutor on your jury, but I decided to do it anyway, knowing that she would ultimately become the foreperson, which of course she did, and my ship was sunk. So, because it was really a valid defense, but at the end of the day, I think that she just said, look, this is kind of like a black and white situation. If you're intoxicated and you're driving, he broke the law. It's guilty. So, but they did deliberate for about 6 hours on a simple DUI. So that was definitely my worst mistake ever.
Lesson learned.
And I knew it. I knew it ahead of time.
Let's talk a little bit about conspiracy, because I see Karen Reed's case as two alleged conspiracies. The first one was the conspiracy to kill the police officer boyfriend, if that's in fact what happened among all the officers at the party. Second one was to cover up and point the finger at Karen. So those are the two allegations, and people love to theorize about those. But a reasonable person usually says, hold on, stop telling me conspiracy theories, that's unreasonable. But in this particular case, it's not, because there's so much now coming out about these officers, nearby officers, cases that involve nearby officers in these officers, aka Sandra Birchmore's case, that are starting to bear out that they do behave in a conspiratorial way. So walk me through how that is going to work itself into trial number two for Karen Reed, especially what they're allowed to bring in and what they're not allowed to bring in.
Yeah, I mean, that'll depend on what happens with Wolf and Rensselaer, the two ARCA experts that they're going to have that were hired by the DOJ, in terms of what they're going to be able to get in. After, I was not a huge fan of the conspiracy theory defense, because not that I didn't believe that it was possible that it was true, but I thought it would be near impossible to get 12 people on a jury to believe that it was true. I think that you'll get the certain portion of the jury to believe that it's possible, and that's all they have to do. Again, remember, yeah, they don't have to prove that beyond a reasonable doubt. They just have to get the jurors to say, well, that could have been exactly what happened, right? That's reasonable doubt. So, like, in my estimation, like, coming out of the first trial, I'm like, man, like, I get it with respect to dealing with the taillight being in the yard, but like, trying to sell that whole thing seems so difficult when you have such powerful witnesses, specifically those two ARCA guys who are just going to get on the stand and say, look, we are biomechanical engineers. We've tried to see any way possible that those injuries or lack thereof on John O'Keefe, that he was hit by that vehicle, and we can't do it. We cannot show, based on the injuries that he sustained, that he was hit by that 6,000-pound SUV. And, you know, I'm leaning into that, because at the end of the day, what I'm trying to do is win the case for my client. I know, especially Alan, definitely they're trying to exonerate her, because this case, you know how toxic it is out there, like with these both warring sides in this case. Those who think that she hit John O'Keefe will always, forever, believe that she hit John O'Keefe, even if she's acquitted. They're not going to be like, oh, all right, well, the jury said, they're not going to care about that. They're always going to think. So I think in their mindset, it was always, we've got to prove that that didn't happen. And the best way to do it is by proving that what happened in that house actually happened. So they've kind of really, they've married that thing. And going into the second trial, they don't seem to have divorced it at all. They seem to be like, they're still going to lean into it. Because to me, it goes to exactly what you were saying 15 minutes ago, where you're like, sometimes you just keep it simple, you know, like you, less is more, all those old axioms that exist, because it's true. Like you lean into the fact that, look, the injuries don't match what they're saying happened. And beyond that, we're going to put two amazing experts on that are going to convince you through science that John O'Keefe was not struck by that vehicle.
Were those the same experts that said that vehicle could not have, I'm trying to remember who said that vehicle could not have been damaged by a human, like a human.
Yeah.
Can't create that kind of damage on a vehicle because of the legitimacy and the integrity of the materials
right
in that portion of the vehicle. You'd have to hit a brick wall to do it.
Right.
You can't hit you can't hit flesh and bone. Those right. Are those the same guys?
Yeah, those are the same guys. So yeah. Those guys were, you know, it was their mindset. Like, so I think Wolf is the one who made the pneumatic potato cannon so that they were firing potatoes out of it, because they were trying to figure out, because in their estimation, based on science, they were saying exactly what you said, that there's no part of John O'Keefe's body that the vehicle, if going 29 miles an hour in reverse, would have shattered that taillight like that. There's no part of his body, including his skull. So like they were trying to figure out, well, what's another way that this thing could have cracked? That's where they kind of came up with the concept that John O'Keefe, who we all know, got out of the vehicle with the glass, the rocks glass from the bar. Like, in like, for me, I'm like, oh, well, I mean, him and Karen are arguing. She's probably pissed off that he's going into the house that late at night. She's like, the kids are home. Why are you still drinking? You're already hammered. Enough is enough. Let's go, John. Probably like pissed off.
So the girl's been in the picture too.
The other girl's in the picture.
Jealousy.
Exactly. So like, whatever, they're beefing. He gets out. You know, she probably screams something out the window when she's leaving, and maybe he takes and whips the glass at the back of the car and hits that taillight. Now, that was kind of the thing that they were trying to figure out, if that rocks glass thrown at full speed by John O'Keefe and he strikes the taillight, could that have done it? And, you know, and my thing was always like, what? Why isn't anybody ever arguing about the concept of him just slipping both feet up out, like under from underneath him, and he just cracks his skull on the back, like on the pavement, not knocked out, gets up and then passes out in the front lawn. Like, I mean, there's just,
well, then there's the injuries though. All those injuries everywhere. How'd they happen then?
Yeah,
if you knock your head, you know.
People give me a lot of grief about this one, but like I Googled, and I encourage you to do it too, Ashley. I want you to Google coyotes in that area that particular year. They were out of control. The feds were actually sending teams in to try to help mitigate the coyote issue in that particular area. And if you look at a map of the other side of the residence, it is a massive
woodland,
massive wooded area. So, I mean, and the concept being that coyotes typically don't want to eat their prey in an area that's visible. So they'll typically try to drag whatever they've killed to an area that's more private. They're always concerned about other animals coming on and trying to feast on their prey. So like the concept
even a coyote could not drag that kind of carrion. I hate to call John O'Keefe carrion, but at that point to a coyote, that's what it is. Couldn't drag something that big. Wouldn't even attempt it, right?
Well, I don't know, but like that might explain, like maybe it tried with its mouth and its paws, and that's what you're seeing with the claw marks in the mouth, and it's like, okay, this dude's two balloons. I can't move him. So it's kind of
the same as like, hey, what about the rock glass going through the back of the, you know, taillight? Hey, right. What about a coyote that tried and failed to get, you know?
I'm just trying to think of a theory that may exist that doesn't require 12 people.
I'm going to weigh in on the unreasonable part here.
I mean,
gone.
Look, I mean, is that any more unreasonable than what the defense is suggesting now? Yeah, because like to a jury, you're always thinking about it in terms of 12 people, right? Like, mm-hmm. like it's, I've seen people that they slip on ice, and we know that it was slippery. We know that John was hammered. We know what his BAC is. If he threw that rocks glass at the back of the car in anger, to like, you know, just pissed off, his feet go out because of the momentum of his throw. Like they go out from underneath him. That is exactly where you would hit your head if you're going like full blown, both legs out from underneath you, and you're falling back on your back and you're smashing your head on the ground. It's exactly where that thing. So the other part of it is, who knows if it was a coyote? Maybe it was Chloe. Maybe it was, like, who knows, some other wild animal. Because remember, it's like the concept of when a storm comes in, like in the animals know that they're going to be holed up for a minute. That's really when they're going to go out and try to get something to be able to eat while they're holed up for sometime days. So it's like there's concepts of it that I think you might be able to sell a little more easily than
that's a tough one though. I'm a way in as the manicurist.
I've gotten some pushback on it for sure.
I'm going to give you a lot of pushback on that.
That's
again, maybe I'm not the right person to ask, because you know I do this for a living. I am entrenched in this, and I feel like I've heard everything. But the manicurist might, and the car mechanic might say, yeah, I guess so. I see a lot of them around my house too. You know, this is their community. They are the peers. They come from here.
Possible.
So it could be. So I love the way you think. I just got to signpost that. Just like I love, man. I mean, like if I get into a murder trial, I'm calling you.
I mean, I'll think of some stuff. You know,
you'll think some stuff up. I love it.
Your night in just got legendary. Get ready to chase the rush, spin, win, and redeem instantly straight to your bank account at legendswithaz.com. With free-to-play slots, blackjack, keno, roulette, and more, experience all the thrills of Vegas without leaving your couch. Legends has it all.
Legends is a free-to-play social casino. Void where prohibited. Must be 18+. Play responsibly. Visit legends.com for full details.
Get in the game now and score a 50% bonus on your first purchase only at legendswithaz.com.
You won't see the engineer that slams the Nissan Rogue's door 13,920 times, or the corrosive chamber that simulates 15 years of life in 5 months, or the Rogue heat-baked for over 300 combined hours. What you will see is a vehicle that can take punch after punch and keep rolling. Nissan, number one in new vehicle quality among mainstream brands by J.D. Power. We put it through the worst so you get its best. For J.D. Power 2025 U.S. initial quality study award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Awards based on 2025 model year. Newer models may be shown.
Let's talk about the craziest part. Well, there's so much crazy, but this is a really crazy part. That the jurors who wrote the note out to the judge saying we can't come to an agreement, it wasn't determined until much later and by the defense that they had indeed come to a few agreements and they had checked some boxes, and that the court did not do its due diligence. And you're going to have to correct me if I'm making any mistakes here, but the court should have canvassed them or looked at their jury forms and said, wait a minute, you did get a verdict on this charge and this charge, but just not on manslaughter. But you did agree that it's not a murder. How is that not the court's fault? Because now in an appeal, it's been thrown back at Karen Reed, and the court has said, no, sorry, too bad. That's not one of those little things that's, like, to me, anyway, layman, curative. Like, it's not. There was a verdict reached, a real verdict, and it's the court's fault for not having checked and asked.
I agree. And ultimately, at the end of the day, so the appellate court ruled against them. They're going to try to bring it up to the Supreme Court in Massachusetts, and they're going to get the same answer, because in Massachusetts, it's not a verdict unless it is recorded in open court. And that's it. It's a hard line rule.
I got that part, but why wasn't it recorded in open court? Failing of the court. Therefore, the court failed the process. Why can't the appellate court, Supreme Court, and I'm going to guess maybe the U.S. Supreme Court, because I do see this as really, really weird.
I agree completely. And when we were covering that portion of it, as you can imagine, I was beside myself, and I pulled up the rule the way it's currently situated, which I have a sneaking suspicion that they're going to change it, that should be mandatory, a polling of the jury in a situation where they're coming out, where you've got multiple counts, that the judge asks, okay, well, I just want to be clear so that you have not reached a verdict on any of the three counts. Like, that simple question would have resolved all of these issues.
Yes.
Because now where she's sitting, she is now in like actual jeopardy of being convicted of second degree murder, which it sounds very
jeopardy,
much like.
Define that, because it really doesn't mean the jeopardy that lay people think. It's the double jeopardy.
Correct.
Of being convicted and then tried again, because
that's
that jury being acquitted and being tried again, because that jury decided she was not guilty of murder and they moved on and couldn't, like, what is it? Aaron Hernandez had a few other charges as well. There was a hung jury on some of the charges. There was guilty on other charges. They were going to retry him, I think, on the hung charges, and then he died.
Right. Exactly. So, and that's the thing with a mistrial, which is basically what happened here, which the most common way that you get a mistrial in any trial is when the jury can't reach a decision, a unanimous decision, and they'll try and they'll try and they'll try. Sometimes they'll get a dynamite charge, or in Massachusetts, they call an Allen charge. So, and
again, that's just it sounds mean and nasty, but all it is the judge, again, for the lay folks, the judge says, hey, this is important. Go back, work it out, use your good judgment, talk amongst yourselves, work harder. And weirdly, it often works.
It does. You know, I mean, there's argument to be made that you're really forcing somebody on that juror to cave, you know, by sending them back. I mean, like, you'll hear a lot of, like, really intelligent like conversations from both sides that they're not fans of those kind of those charges to the jury, forcing them to go back when they've told you multiple times we can't reach a conclusion, because you know somebody's capitulating back there, somebody's giving in, and you know that's not the way that they feel. They've fought.
Can I be devil's advocate?
Yeah.
That's what happens even before an Allen charge. A lot of times people can be convinced when they're not. And that's how you get to unanimity, because people come in, and if they're deliberating for multiple hours, they usually, not always, but quite often from reports back, juries go in and they say, hi, everybody. Okay, now we're allowed to talk. Should we just go around the table once and see how everybody feels?
Right.
And oftentimes that's where you'll find the divisions, or that's where you'll find the unanimity. But they will say, well, we A, got to get lunch because it's free.
Right.
And B, no, not a word of a lie there.
Right.
And B, I think we're supposed to work harder at this. So let's just at least go over stuff and make sure we didn't mess up. Then they,
right.
You know, stay at unanimity. Or the debate begins, and eventually the debate changes minds. So the fact that an Allen charge may just say go back and continue the debate,
right.
I get what you're saying, but I also get that the debate changing minds was happening before Allen charge too.
Yeah, I mean, it depends on how deep you are and how many notes they've sent back. You know what I'm saying? So like in that particular situation, I think they were on their third note, and they do have something in place in the Commonwealth there where basically both sides have to reach the conclusion that it's now time to give it. You know what I mean? So like it's not strictly the judge's decision. Both sides have to say, I think it's a proper time to give the charge. So which happened here. But to your main point, the biggest problem is that Judge Cannone did not ask that question. And in light of the fact that Alan Jackson had argued about that exact point, the fact that there was no box for them to check not guilty on counts 1 and 3, and Judge Cannone gave him a ton. It was an epic argument. And his argument was, well, you're not giving them the opportunity to say guilty or not guilty. She's like, well, we can get it by inference. If they haven't checked guilty, then we know that it's not guilty. Instead of just saying, yeah, you're right, let's just put the not guilty box, because had that even happened, then that would have probably alleviated this situation. So like Jackson had given her an out in terms of being able to clarify those jury instructions and the verdict slips. She chose not to take it. But the other part of it is it is in the statute. It's in the criminal rules, the criminal procedure rules out there, that either party can ask the judge to inquire as to each count if they are in fact.
So Alan should have done it too.
Alan could have done it. The state could have done it. You know, it's one of those things. Or the judge could have done it on her own accord.
Can I just ask?
So infatuated with those notes.
Yeah, I am like mystified by how prosecutors and defense attorneys don't automatically do a polling of the jury no matter what. And I have seen so many cases where they don't poll the jury. And everyone always thinks, oh, this is dumb. Why are we polling the jury? They already said what they said. But there have been multiple cases in the polling, someone says, actually, no.
Right.
I don't feel good about this. And it's like, wait, are you kidding me? Why isn't it automatic? It takes 1 minute to have 12 people say, yes, Your Honor. Yes, Your Honor, it is. Yes,
right.
It is my decision. It takes 1 minute, and it just finalizes the record. It's just such an important, it's like putting the plug in the back of the boat before you launch it.
It's huge. I don't
get why they wouldn't.
I think it's ineffective assistance of counsel if they don't do it. It's like, why wouldn't you do that? Because of exactly what you said, and it's going back to that deliberation. What's going on back in that room? If you have a 12 angry men situation with Henry Fonda and they're trying to guide the jury through, and you know, you get somebody to kind of cave, and they may not feel comfortable back there because they feel like they've been pressured to come to this verdict for whatever reason, could be a multitude, and then they get the opportunity out there when the judge asks, you know, is this your verdict, is this the way that you feel about it, and if they, that could be their first opportunity to be outside of that room with those other people where they feel free enough to say,
Save me.
I got an issue. Yeah.
Save me.
Right. Yeah. So it's,
I've been emotional hostage for the last 7 days. Yeah.
No, I
think you're right.
Yeah.
So tell me one other thing. It's not going to be one other thing, you know, I kid. But the grave concern that the judge voiced the other day about the defense behavior, immediately I thought, wait a minute, I know Alan Jackson. There's no way he would have stood up and multiple times on the record in front of everyone said, and you haven't received money from us, correct? And the expert witness says, that's correct, sir. And we haven't paid you. And we haven't talked about this before today, correct? That's right. So this is like you're asking, if two people lied in court, one an officer of the court and two a witness under threat of perjury, it just didn't sound like it was possible to me. What am I missing here?
I don't know, because I was saying the exact same thing. I'm like, Alan Jackson has worked very, very hard to build his reputation for decades. And I'm like, and I literally said this last week. I was like, and then when he doubled up talking to the media after the hearing, and he said, we absolutely did not pay the bill. I'm like, there's no way he doubled down. Like, I'm like, I will eat crow. I will die on this hill. There's no way that they paid that bill.
And I was getting the impression. Help me here, because sometimes I lose the arcane aspects of everything with doing 1,000 trials a week. But I thought that he had plausible deniability there because there was a different, like there was some sort of an agency that was actually, I believe, government related that had paid those experts. Therefore, the defense did not pay the experts. And for anybody listening right now who is a layperson, it is absolutely normal in trials for each side to pay experts, because these experts are giving sometimes weeks of their life and they're getting on planes and traveling for trials. It is absolutely normal to pay experts for their expert opinions and testimony in a case. That's not the infraction here. It's disclosing it. And the allegation is that the defense didn't disclose these experts and actually had paid them. But I sort of thought I had put those pieces together saying it's true they hadn't. There was a tangential agency that had done the paying and it wasn't the defense. Am I wrong?
No, you're right. And because I did the same thing after the fact, like when I first heard about it, I'm like, all right, because you could pull up and it was the feds were paying for it. The Department of Justice was paying for it because they had hired them because of what you were talking about. This whole investigation started because of the Sandra Birchmore case that you were first talking about. When you get the bleed over of cops, the same cops working on both cases, and then they catch wind of what the defense is saying in the Reed case about this conspiracy and the corruption that's going on in that case, that's what caused them to kind of look at this and say, all right, well, let's see if what the defense is saying has any legs here, because we're seeing what's going on in the Birchmore case, and it definitely has legs there. So they end up hiring ARCA. So ARCA gets hired and they get paid $29,000 by the federal government. They pay them out. But there's also another factor. There's the protective order that's in place. The protective order is one of the things that none of us know about yet, because we don't know what the language is in there. We heard some about what, you know, happened when they initially called the feds and they're like, hey, can we talk to these guys? They're like, no. Or you can talk to them about background. Okay, but and you can't talk to them about their going into trial. You can't talk to them about their opinion and how they reached it. So they were limited in terms of what they could communicate with them about. And then the problem with the money is that even though ARCA, once they were disengaged from the federal government and they were then kind of a free agent, at that point, even when the defense, after the voir dire of the witnesses, when Judge Cannone decided that they were going to be able to testify and they were going to be able to be listed as defense witnesses, the defense obviously would think that it was incumbent upon themselves to pay their bill for travel expenses, for eating, for housing, whether when they put them up in a hotel. So, like, from that perspective, they're not paying them for their opinion.
It's just logistics.
Right, because the one thing that's very, very important to remember, and I think that will probably be the saving grace for Alan Jackson with respect to that issue, is the fact that they had formed their opinion and done the testing long before either the Commonwealth or the defense had any idea that they were doing it. They came to learn it after the fact. So whatever, and he did not change his opinion at all from what was written in the report. It was the same thing. You know, I mean, there's some intricacies in there in that argument that it all boils down to candor to the court and whether or not when they asked that question during the first trial, have you been paid anything? And it was really during the voir dire where he asked, have you been paid anything by the defense? He's like, no, because it's that concept of that they're independent witnesses, which makes them so powerful.
So much more powerful.
Because if I'm hiring an expert as a defense, the first thing the prosecution says, well, they're a hired gun. They're being paid by, how much did you get paid by the defense?
How much did you get paid?
Right. And so it's like.
But, you know, like, again, just the devil's always in the details. And here's a really tiny one. If the defense paid the hotel bill, they did not pay the expert. If the defense paid the expert for reimbursement for the hotel bill, they still haven't paid them because they're not that expert is not up. They were down and they were made whole again, which is not being paid.
Right.
I mean, you could just on a technicality, you could just.
But that's true. That's exactly the point. Like you're not paying them for their services. You're paying for their
logistics.
Expenses. Yeah. And I think it's a distinction that Judge Cannone will come to think that. I agree with that side of it because remember they did call and they called before they paid the invoice. They called the feds and said, "Hey, do we pay this invoice?" Because they were not trying to step on the toes of the feds, And that was put in by Alessi when he was arguing. He said, "Look, they called the assistant U.S. attorney on this thing and asked." Do we pay this? And the guy said, yeah, go ahead and pay it. So that's when they paid it. So like the bigger issue from the Commonwealth is that the way that they were represented at trial, that they were this independent thing when in Hank Brennan's mind that he believes that there was actually a relationship had been formed so that they weren't truly independent anymore, that because of the fact that, and remember, either side could have called them. It just so happened that the evidence that they had in terms of the report worked in the favor of the defense. So they're like, it's like a
and the stickler for details worked in the favor of the prosecution when they didn't ask if you've already come to a verdict. I mean,
exactly.
Same treatment on either. So one last question.
Yep.
And that is that the most recent thing that was just sort of an eye popper was that the defense filed a motion to dismiss. And I think the language was based on extraordinary government misconduct. Which part? Like, what is it specific exactly what misconduct the defense is pointing to here?
Yeah, they were very so specifically what they were talking about is like the Sally Port video, which if you're not familiar with the case, one of the big things that came up during the first trial was there was the video of the Sally Port, which is kind of a garage at the law enforcement in Canton's police department, I believe that's where it was, wherein they were storing Karen Reed's vehicle. So they brought it, when they towed it from the location where it was, they brought it back to the Sally Port, and the defense wanted that. They had been, part of their conspiracy theory is that they had taken the shattered taillight and they had spread it out on John O'Keefe's lawn. And what the defense was saying is we think that it happened at the Sally Port.
That the Sally Port was where that headlight, that taillight was broken.
Exactly. And so they wanted the video. And so what they're saying is that it took them over 2 years to get the video from the Commonwealth. Mm. And when they got it piecemeal. And there's chunks of time missing. And there's never been an explanation on why it took 2+ years at the eve of trial. They finally get this video. We then had the problem at trial wherein they show an inverted video where they switched the way that the camera looks so that it's showing the opposite so that it's not showing the cop that you can see clearly behind when you're watching the original uninverted video. You can see the cop behind near that taillight. So the thing might have legs. The thing might have legs. I mean, they came with a pretty – it's nothing new in terms of the concepts. It's the same things that they were arguing about during that trial. But now they've put it in a cogent motion that's pretty powerful. And now the Commonwealth's response has come out. I didn't find it very compelling in terms of – coming up with a reasonable explanation of why this evidence wasn't turned over, why they inverted the video. You have an expectation of judges that what's good for the goose is good for the gander. If you're going to hammer the defense for being shifty, you've got to do the same thing to the Commonwealth or the state. You know, they're not on a different playing field. They're on the exact same playing field, and it should go both ways. And it seems like it hasn't. I mean, like I expected when that came out that was an inverted video. And what they were trying to do with it, I thought that she would have been outraged, and she didn't bat an eye.
Well, obviously, you and I have another date coming.
For sure.
Because this is fascinating stuff, and you're just the perfect person to talk to because A, you are steeped in the case, and B, you're super duper smart.
Thanks,
and so
Rachel.
I knew you'd have lots of answers for my many, many questions. Bob Mata, thank you so much.
Always. I love hanging with you. Let's do it again.
It's a promise.
All right.
Okay, there you have it. So as we await this retrial, is Karen Reed going to prevail in trial number two? Is she going to fail in trial number two? What do the jurors all know already, right? Jury pool coming in? They've all heard about this. They've even been through a trial in the media. How hard is it going to be to pick jurors who, even if they've heard about the case, agree and prove to the court they can be fair and impartial? And then what about the media on this one? Because man, oh man, it was big in round one and the battle has just become more epic in round two. I can promise you this, I am going to be following it. And I hope you will too. Thank you so much for staying with me on Drop Dead Serious, my podcast. I'm just thrilled that you're a part of this. As always, I ask if you could do me a big favor and just subscribe, rate, and leave a review, even if you hate me. I'm good with that. It helps me get better. But it really does help the podcast, and it does help me in how I cover these cases as well. I always love it if you leave a review and tell me cases you want me to cover as well. I've got to pick a case every single week, if not more. Sometimes I do bonus episodes as well, which is why I also ask you to subscribe, but also sign up for alerts, because alerts, they tell you when I'm dropping bonus episodes unexpectedly. And that happens, right? That just happens. If you're watching on YouTube, definitely leave a comment below, like, subscribe and all the rest, but definitely leave me a comment below. Tell me what you like. Tell me what you didn't like. Tell me what your thoughts are on the case and tell me what cases you'd really like me to look into as well. Because, you know, I just love reading your comments and then formulating this work based on you. Like, we're all a group here. We're all a community. So I want it to be a two-way conversation. Don't forget to check out Defense Diaries, Bob Mata's podcast, because it's a good one. Again, smart potato, that guy. And as always, I leave you with this. The truth is not just serious. It is drop dead serious.
Legends, the greatest social casino experience has arrived at Legends.com. With thousands of the best free-to-play casino-style games, chances to earn millions of bonus coins and win real money. Legends is revolutionizing the Vegas experience wherever you are. If you love winning, then you'll love playing at Legends.com. Legends is a free-to-play social casino. Void where prohibited. Play responsibly. Visit Legends.com for more information. Legends with a Z.com is legendary fun.
Cleveland is where the urban meets the outdoors, where cultural celebrations meet rabid sports fans meet the symphony, where nobody goes hungry and everybody loves music. Fueled by passion, we are the land for life. From rich history to hidden gems, the Legends of the Land podcast shares the real stories from real Clevelanders that shape the city. From iconic chefs to grassroots changemakers, sports heroes to creative visionaries, learn why living all out is in Cleveland's DNA. Go to thisiscle.com/podcast.